Hello, the internet, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 2 of the Daily Zeitgeist for November 7th, 2017. My name is Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. Potatoes O'Brien, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray.
Greetings, everybody. I hope you're having a blessed day. This is my new positive spin I'm trying to do on my opening.
Very peaceful, Miles.
Yes, bless you all.
And we're thrilled to be joined in our third seat by the hilarious writer and humorist, Dave Schilling.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hey. How's it going, Dave?
Oh, hello. Hi.
How art thou?
I is good.
Ooh.
Yeah, a little Shakespeare for us.
A little Queen's English.
Yes.
Dave, what is something that you've searched in the not-too-distant past that is revealing about who you are as a human being?
Oh, well, I got to announce right up front that I recently had a child, so I've been searching for... Hey, hello! He was born the day of Game 7 of the World Series, so he's absolutely cursed. I searched dinosaurs baby on Google recently, this morning actually, because I think my kid looks like the baby from Dinosaurs.
Oh, really?
From Not the Mama?
Exactly. Not the Mama. And then he hits the dad with the saucepan. That guy. Because it's the same skin tone. He's a biracial kid, so he's very, like, he's tan, he's creamy, but he's not too, it's like my coffee, but with a little bit more of that delicious cream stuff. So I tweeted, I love my son in a picture of the dinosaurs baby. And everybody was like, you are not nice to your kid. He's 5 days old, and you're already comparing him to a Muppet.
I remembered him as purple, the dinosaur's baby.
Well, didn't he have, like, purple spots?
He had purple pants, didn't he?
Maybe.
I thought he was always in a diaper or something. Or
definitely
a
diaper.
I remember my uncle was, first AD, and he worked on that show, and I went to the set. It was the most heartbreaking shit to see as a kid.
Miles, my uncle wrote for dinosaurs.
Really?
That's crazy.
Holy shit.
Is that real?
Yeah.
See?
What?
Jim Henson bringing us all together.
I knew there was some
yet again
some reason
something
we came
about
together.
You, yeah.
This is the dinosaurs reunion.
Of our uncles.
Greatest series finale of all time because all the characters die at the end.
Isn't that
right?
Unbelievable?
It's awesome.
That's actually kind of appropriate for today's
episode. Makes sense,
episode.
Though, too.
So what's something that you believe to be overrated?
Oh, I'm going to start with black ice cream. What is going on with this? I see it on Instagram all the time. People are like, got cones with this vanilla ice cream, but it's black because it has charcoal in it. It's still vanilla ice cream. I grew up with Crystal Pepsi, and the gimmick was it's a different color than what you're used to, and no one liked it. I mean, I ironically drink it now when I see it at Target or something, but it wasn't good. So why are people so obsessed with black ice cream? Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Is this totally, like, over your head?
I know, like, black sesame ice cream. I didn't know that they were just straight up making vanilla ice cream look black.
There's a place downtown, I think it's called Little Damage in Los Angeles, and they sell black ice cream, black vanilla ice cream.
And are they touting any kind of, like, health benefits because of charcoal? They're just like, hey, we got black ice cream.
I think charcoal is supposed to be good for your, it's like it purifies you in some
way.
Right. Or good for hangovers, but I don't think they say that. I think they just say, come take a picture with this ice cream. It's a funny color.
Right.
Makes me mad.
If that, you can't trust the health advice of gimmick ice cream, then yeah. Who can you trust?
I don't know.
What's something you think is underrated?
Being a parent. It's great.
Hey.
I thought it would be just a piss and poop explosion, but there's actually moments of real joy when you're not cleaning up his butt.
Yeah.
Or his wiener.
Yeah. Hmm.
What kind of joy are we talking here?
What?
I have no idea. I'm not a parent.
He looks at you while he's farting and it looks like a smile or you put like a funny costume on him. Like I bought him a suit at Target with a little bow tie and I'm like, ah, you're the mayor of Baby Town. Look at you.
You're like, now sign this decree.
Yes. Get him a top hat and a monocle and then he's Mr. Peanut.
Yeah. This actually sounds great.
Yeah.
Is there a place to rent babies for this kind of thing?
You come to my house, give me $50, you can have them for a week.
Great. Cool. I have costumes and everything.
Just don't drop him on his soft spot.
No. I have a calendar I'm working on, so this will be great.
Yeah, you can like push on the little soft spot and like make one of his limbs twitch.
Oh, wait, what?
No, I'm going to throw up.
I don't know, because you know about medicine in your family. So
I have a Making America Great hat down here I'm going to throw up.
Yeah, and the good news is that this is something that I hadn't heard before I had a kid, but that it only gets better. It gets more and more fun. Like the
further they get into life, they get like more of a personality, and it just keeps getting more and more fun.
Did you ever at one point say, man, this is kind of more than I signed up for?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, constantly.
So that does happen.
Like last night.
Oh, what do you
mean? No. I kind of knew what I was getting into.
What's the hardest thing? Is it the sleep? I feel like that's...
Yeah, sleep is tough.
I slept 4 hours last night.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. So if I'm not funny, it's because of that. Because
your baby.
Yes, my child.
Blame your child.
It's a perfect excuse for any career failure. Oh, I got a kid now.
Well, that's true. Because also, like, I know, like, I've worked with people who, you know, when I was, like, producing video and stuff, who had come in and shoot stuff, and they'd be like, look, dude, I got to get home, my baby and stuff. And, like, they were cutting out so early, but you can't really argue with that.
Right, because you don't have a baby.
It's also, yeah, it's a great excuse.
Mm-hmm.
I might just have a baby for the excuses.
Right.
Okay, cool.
Except I have a baby, so I can just be like, yeah, so what? I got a baby.
Yeah, right. And then I'm like,
I'm still here.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I got two, man. So, and then you're like, yeah, well,
one of them's black.
Yeah.
Let's get into the show. So before we get into the stories, we like to state our purpose up top. We're trying to take a sample of the ideas that are out there changing the world. That's why it's the Daily Zeitgeist. We talk about politics, the president, the news. We also talk about movies and supermarket tabloids. And we want to start up top. Talking to you, Dave, about this is sort of a new segment that we've spontaneously developed, but we're asking our guests, like, what is something, some myth that they've noticed that keeps coming up in movies that isn't actually true based on their own personal experience?
Okay, so I am in an interracial couple. I am the product of an interracial couple, so I have a lot of experience with race mixing.
Mm.
And there's a genre of filmmaking, doesn't really have a name yet, but it should have a name, where the conceit is the parents are one race of the male character, and the female character's parents are of another race. And isn't it funny that they get together and they don't understand each other? This happens in movies like Get Out, obviously, that came out this year. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The remake with Bernie Mac and Ashton Kutcher called Guess Who. And basically, the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding is about this. There's just a ton of these movies where there's no other joke besides, can you believe that these people eat this wacky food? Well, let me tell you something, folks. It's not that difficult to have your parents meet your future in-laws. Usually people are nice to each other. Typically, people find a way to get along. I don't understand why there's so many movies about how weird it is that white people and black people are different.
Right.
At the same time, they are kind of different. It's just that, like, we're still all people.
Right.
So I've never related to those movies where it's like, ooh, I better tiptoe over the fact that my family owned slaves in the Civil War or something. That just doesn't happen.
Right. Miles, you're also
I'm also product of the old race mixing as well, and it's weird. It's very true. Like every time, inherently, like that, my parents have met like a girlfriend's parents. It's always like they just find common ground immediately over weird shit.
Yeah,
like most recently, my girlfriend, her dad came by, and my dad, and like to my dad's, and like they met. And he was like, oh, you got that vape pen too? He's like, yeah, what strain is this? I'm like, wow, okay. So you just, like, you could tell because they're both, like, you know, old hippies. So they are immediately like, oh, I know you. I know you. So, it's never like, wow, you use Tide instead of Gain?
Right.
That kind of thing. Like, there's never anything like that. And I think, in the movies that portray that, like, presupposes, like, people who meet each other on the street, like, white people don't, like, or black people don't see white people. I'm like, whoa, do you see that? You see how they're doing that?
Yeah.
Look at how big their feet are.
Yeah, exactly.
My God. I've never seen feet that big.
Right.
Yeah. My in-laws are Korean and, like, very Korean. Like, they still mostly speak Korean around the house. And, yeah, we were able to find stuff to talk about.
What was your first bit of common ground you noticed?
They went out of their way to, like, make Thanksgiving dinner for me. And, like, I didn't realize, like, I went home with my then girlfriend and I thought that everybody celebrated Thanksgiving dinner. And, like, halfway through Thanksgiving, my wife was like, oh, they've never done this before. We've never had Thanksgiving dinner.
Like,
we
really
usually just go out to eat on Thanksgiving. And it was really well done. And also the fact that I love Korean food was a big bonus.
Yeah.
Is there a YouTube tutorial for how to put on a Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah, for like non-American people.
Right. This is the point where the mother and the son need to have a serious argument.
Right, right.
This is where all the gay rumors come out.
Right.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. And then your problematic uncle says something vaguely racist.
Right.
That's great.
All right. Let's get into some stories, guys. So first up, we want to just talk about the constantly developing Weinstein story. And for once, the development is interesting and not just like thoroughly defeating and depressing in an existential way. Although
in
kind
a way
of
it
is.
Is
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of that. It's just it's compelling because it feels like a whole world has opened to us that I wasn't aware existed. So, Ronan Farrow, who, wrote the original New Yorker article where I think it was the first place that, people were accusing him of rape. And so he just dropped another New Yorker article about this huge sort of corporate spy network, that Weinstein had working for him for the past like 5 to 10 years, sort of trying to keep these accusations under wraps. There was like a firm called Black Cube that specializes in sort of corporate espionage and is full of ex-Mossad agents who like use false identities and like infiltrate. Like one of them was a woman who pretended like she was a feminist and met with the actress Rose McGowan. She was like trying to find out what she would be willing to accuse Weinstein of. And like they had all these meetings where she was like, oh, you're so brave. I'm so proud of what you're doing.
Jesus.
And she was secretly like reporting back to Weinstein and this company. There were also like journalists that he had sort of digging into, you know, different stories for him to just try and like get ahead of the story. And it just seems like, I mean, it's crazy, and just on its own, but it also seems to open up this world of like rich guy damage control, like where rich guys are, you know, we tend to think, oh, you know, they become corrupt and like do these bad things and just like lose track of the consequences. And he was fully aware of the consequences and was just actively like, you know, trying to keep the consequences at bay. And, I mean, these sorts of type A people who, you know, run entire companies, and who end up becoming enormously wealthy, it makes sense that they would have these elaborate ways to sort of keep themselves free from, you know, the public eye or, you know,
right,
the consequences of their actions.
Well, it's just crazy how effective this, clearly they've been putting in a lot of work to try and keep this under wraps. And I think Asia Argento today tweeted, it was like, you know, why do you think it took long for like people like myself and Rose McGowan to come out? It's because like ex-Mossad agents are following me and trying to silence me. It's a whole new level. I mean, that's a level of wealth like I can't even comprehend of having a goon army.
Yeah, first of all, Black Cube sounds like the name of a Sci-Fi Channel original movie starring Antonio Sabato Jr. Second of all,
you can never escape
the Black Cube. Second of all, doesn't this make you paranoid on some level?
Oh, hell yeah.
Anyone who's trying to ingratiate themselves to you is trying to get information because someone wants to take you down.
Right.
That's terrifying to me. That said, we all live in Los Angeles where it's probably smart to be paranoid. I don't know. But this is another level of paranoid. When I imagine what these sort of like private investigators are like, I always think about like Anthony Pelicano or the show Ray Donovan or Winston Wolfe in Pulp Fiction. It's just
right.
Like some kind of sleazy guy that you call on a burner cell phone and they come and they like bury a dead body for you. But these are former spies. This is like a company that you hire that is allegedly legitimate in some way. Even though it's very seedy business, these are people. There's a Wikipedia page you're looking at for Black Cube.
For Black Cube, yeah. And all the numerous things they do. I mean, like, it seems like their thing is to like get people on tape too. Like they seem to be really good at that. They've apparently there was like a dispute between two companies, and like during the litigation, like they're anyway, they basically proved that one of the companies gave false testimony by like talking to a dude and getting him to say something that was completely contrary to what they're doing. So they're in the business of like, hey man, you got fucking problems, like we can correct them.
How do I hire them to get rid of Trump? Like, can we just start a Kickstarter to hire Black Cube to get Trump out of office?
I mean, that's assuming that Trump doesn't already have this entire industry working for him, which, I don't know, it's probably not that safe an assumption because, I don't know, if rich people who have a background of sexually abusing and assaulting people are, like, using these means to sort of keep the public eye at bay, he would seem to be a candidate, possibly. It's so, it's just like so transparently nefarious. Black Cube, it's like black box. It's like, we specialize in just keeping things
in
opaque.
Dark shit, yeah.
Black water, that's another one, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, why couldn't it just be something like, you know, risk consultants?
Right.
That would even be like less
Obsidian.
Dark. Right. Yeah, right.
Right. They also, we have another instance of one of our recurring segments on the show is Bloid Watch.
Bloid Watch.
Where we, I don't know if people think that's a drop, but that's always
not
just
that's
mild
live.
Dropping. I can't believe you do that live every week, man. That's
every
talent.
It's tough.
But we look at the front page of different tabloids that people are passing by in the supermarkets because those are getting as many eyeballs as any website or newspaper out there. But they are all made by the same company, and it is a hugely pro-Trump company. They're called American Media Inc. And, you know, their publisher is a good friend of Donald Trump. And they were actually being used by Weinstein to investigate Rose McGowan and, like, try and get some dirt on her or get examples of her lying or something, just, you know, doing oppo research on somebody who Weinstein knew he had raped and wanted to, you know, be able to discredit when she eventually told people.
I wonder when. So and it's funny now because he's like emblazoned on every week on the cover of like the Inquirer or Globe or things like that. Like what's the moment where they're like, okay, so we're going to make him the subject now because what is he not paying, or they have moral scruples
I
now?
I think they don't care. I think it's just like, all right, you know, chum in the water. Let's start feeding. There's no actual moral compass for any of these people. It's just money.
Right.
Right. And I think it was a member of their chief content officer who was working as an independent contractor for Weinstein. But I mean, obviously using the fact that he is
the chief content officer, right,
of a tabloid empire to, get information on different people. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm hoping Ronan Farrow continues his work as like the superhero of fucking up rich, corrupt people and uncovers this, you know, huge empire of bullshit that I'm assuming is out there because, you know, this is just the guy we're finding out about.
Right.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me that Harvey Weinstein is this gigantic Democratic Party donor for years, and then he gets in bed with Trump supporters. Like there's no line that a wealthy person with demons and skeletons will not cross.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Predators are, you know, they have completely evolved as human beings to prey on other people, and so like that is their survival instinct, is like, how do I continue to prey?
And they're not cool predators like the Predator, you know. They don't have
dreadlocks.
Heat vision or dreadlocks, right, or an arm-mounted cannon.
Right. Instead of heat vision, they have like an instinct for making people who they prey on look like liars or whatever the
and
fuck.
And instead of camouflage, they hire companies like Black Cube with ex-Mossad agents.
Right. Oh, all right. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back after this. And we're back. So for our sort of evergreen piece, we wanted to look at what a nuclear explosion would actually look like. We've talked before on our show about how movies tend to, you know, inform what our cultural imagination looks like. And, you know, at least in my case, and I found this was the case whenever we were writing for Cracked and debunking cultural myths, all we would have to do is think about the most well-known movie scene depicting a given event or a given period in history or a given war, and that is what people imagined that event being like. And an example of that that I always go to is the, I feel like anytime I picture a nuclear explosion, I am picturing the scene from Terminator 2 when Sarah Connor is dreaming of what Judgment Day would eventually look like.
Just taking her kid to the park.
Yeah. You know? So she's got her kid in the park, and then also she is like watching herself take her kid to the park. But there's a big blinding white light, and then a mushroom cloud, and then a wave of fire that just like basically disintegrates everything in its path.
And essentially what just turns into a skeleton.
Right. Everybody like turns into a pile of ash basically right away. She disintegrates down to a skeleton and then, you know, is blown away by this wind that comes with a nuclear explosion, which, okay, so they definitely got some things absolutely right. The blinding flash that kicks the party off, and the huge blast of wind that comes through. Apparently there's like a 700 mile per hour wind that comes through with a nuclear explosion. But when you look at the people who actually survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are some things that, you know, we just don't picture and that I haven't seen really in any pop culture depiction of a nuclear explosion. For instance, there were survivors that were within 300 feet of the explosion in Hiroshima, which just seems impossible based on my idea of what a nuclear explosion
or James was. Or James Cameron's idea.
Right. Yeah. Which he put inside my head. And I, you know, there are other nuclear explosions in pop culture. Usually we see them at a distance because mushroom clouds are cool looking. And so filmmakers know that and like to keep it at a distance. But yeah, there were people who were within 300 feet of the mushroom cloud, like ground zero, and still survived. They were just behind a wall, and so, you know, they didn't get the brunt of that 700 mile per hour wind, and they didn't get, like, cooked alive by the giant blast of heat that comes from the nuclear explosion. I guess I assumed that when people, like, you hear about there being these shadows that are still there in these places where nuclear explosions went off, like shadows of people. And I assumed that was just like from them, like being immediately disintegrated. But essentially what happens is it's like a huge flashbulb of a camera that it's hotter than the surface of the sun. And it's actually a reverse shadow because it burns the ground that it touches, that the light touches. And then, you know, your shadow is one of the only things that escapes being burnt. So you are able to survive. Back at Cracked, we interviewed one of the survivors of Hiroshima. And one of the things that she credits with saving her is that she was a kid at the time. And so there was a air raid siren that went off the night before. And she put two pairs of pants on because she thought, okay, I'm going to go to this shelter, and if my house burns down, at least I'll have two pairs of pants. And then the siren went off. She went back to sleep. When she woke up the next morning, she forgot to take off her second pair of pants. And like after the explosion, her body was like burnt everywhere except where her pants were. Like having two pairs of pants actually kept her like completely unburned in that part of her body, because it's just like a really weird scientific phenomenon. Like it's not just a wave that like disintegrates everything in its path. It's like a blast of heat. A lot of people describe it as feeling like, you know, when you open an oven door and, you know, feel that wave of heat, but it doesn't just automatically disintegrate you. after the explosion goes off, there, like, it was a completely clear day in Hiroshima, the day of the bombing. And they said, like, after the explosion, the sky was completely clouded over, and then it immediately begins to rain, because, you know, it's like the air suddenly gets, you know, hundreds of degrees hotter. And so the moisture in the air, like, comes out as, they describe it as being like the biggest raindrops they'd ever seen. They were like bucket sized raindrops that were just like falling on them from the sky.
And it's also like combining with like the evaporated or disintegrated debris that's
right.
that's thrown up in the air as well.
Yeah, it's they call it black rain because it's like this black sticky rain because it's combining with all the irradiated stuff that just got thrown up. And yeah, but the raindrops are so big that they actually like hurt when they hit you. There's like fire tornadoes because everything's on fire and there's tons of wind all over the place. And you have a lot of people who are walking around, you know, who survived. They didn't get immediately disintegrated, but they're, you know, badly burnt. And, you know, the stuff that these survivors describe is stuff that you would see in The Walking Dead. It really like seems like that sort of, you know, horror.
Yeah. When I was a kid, my mom took me to the Hiroshima, the Memorial Museum, where they have like the dome that still stands from where the bomb was dropped directly above. And then inside the museum, they have cut out pieces of concrete that have shadows burnt onto them. And they also, the thing that like really shook me was when you walk through, they have like these sort of wax figure depictions of what like sort of the immediate aftermath looked like in the debris. And yeah, it's horrific. It's like, if you weren't killed immediately in that first blast, the heat, just the third degree burns that these people suffered, it's mind blowing. And I think what's crazy to think is like, that's a bomb that went off, what, in 1945?
Yeah.
If God forbid anything like that happens again, the weaponry that is out there now is far more advanced than even this.
Yeah, it can only get worse, basically, because people are trying to kill people more efficiently, which is a terrifying thought. When I think about Terminator 2, I think about, you know, that's it looked cool. To Jack's point, you know, like, that's what you think about when you think about nuclear devastation. But there are movies out there that have more realistic depictions of what would happen. There's a great TV movie from the early 80s called The Day After that was directed by Nicholas Meyer, who also directed Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And that was a seminal movie for a lot of people of that time because it imagined what it would actually be like if there was a nuclear conflict. We don't have that for climate change. When you think about climate change movies, you think about The Day After Tomorrow and Waterworld.
Yeah. Right.
And The Core. Kind of, I mean, like the similar disaster porn films. But yeah, with climate change. Yeah.
When are we going to get a thing where it's like, this is what it would actually happen? Would actually happen if Malibu was underwater suddenly?
Right.
Know, we haven't gotten to that point where we can dramatize disasters of that magnitude in a respectful and you know, realistic way.
Right.
So I think as long as we don't have that, we're gonna constantly be on the precipice of destroying our planet.
Well, and it's interesting thing too. Even in the aftermath of the atomic bombs being dropped, a lot of the images weren't being seen by Americans.
Right.
And to kind of give you an idea of like what the environment was even like in the U.S. at the time, in 1944, there was a poll that asked Americans what should be done with Japan, and it found that 13% of, you know, the U.S. public was actually in favor of, quote, killing off all Japanese people, which is fucking wild. And to that, after the fact, I think there was like, obviously, they were very careful about not letting people see like what these bombs were capable of. Cause I think even at the time, the Allies, like Churchill and Stalin, they just thought what they were talking about was just a bigger bomb.
Right.
Not quite understanding like what the actual effect of an atomic bomb was. And it's wild to think now after the fact that many of the people who observed the Ground Zero and the effects of the radiation, who are just like, holy, like, this is a completely evil abomination of some kind of a weapon.
Human beings actually have to make a terrible mistake before they can realize it's a mistake.
Right.
That's the most terrible part about history, is that we will never just avoid doing something wrong. We have to do it first. Like, you have to lick a car battery to see if it electrifies you or not.
A car? That's a big-ass battery.
Well, sure, yeah.
I started off with a 9-volt.
Okay, well, you know, I got a little bit farther, and
in my battery-licking game?
Yeah, and a lot of times we like to make that mistake twice just to see how that goes.
Right. And with, at the moment, what Trump is in Asia, I think in South Korea right now. I mean, again, this is something you absolutely hope we do not repeat this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And this has been on my mind for because Trump has been talking
like just casually about this shit,
casual and insane amounts of shit towards North Korea. And also a defector from North Korea has said that, if he did, you know, launch a nuke at the United States, it would definitely be at L.A. because he's like a pop culture fiend, and like that would be like the biggest impact in his mind.
Yeah, I think it was if he felt any threat to his regime, that's like his end game.
Yeah.
Is to destroy Warner Brothers and Paramount and all the beautiful entertainment.
Yeah.
Right. But then he's going to take over and make all the movies.
I hear he's a great director.
Yeah. He's got a vision.
Yeah.
I mean, his early stuff was a little derivative, but he's come along.
He's like Kevin Smith. He's grown.
Yeah, exactly.
But I guess the, just, you know, you always hear things like, duck and cover is like what they used to tell kids to do. And that's insane because obviously, you're just going to be disintegrated by a nuclear bomb. And that's actually not necessarily true. I don't know that ducking and covering helps, but certainly, I was surprised to learn that wearing two pairs of clothes could help, because that has never been a thing that anybody has ever said.
Right.
You know, the woman we talked to, she was pointing at the plane in the sky, the Enola Gay, when the bomb exploded, and because her arm was up like that, the underside of her arm is like the most burnt part of her body. It's like still to this day, it's like got that like kind of polished, really smoothed look because she had a really bad burn on the underside of her arm. So it's a lot of it is weirdly like covering your skin from the initial explosion. Her father was like, I guess, in a fishing sort of shack, and he had a big cement ice box that was in there, like basically a refrigerator. And when he saw the bomb falling, he jumped inside his ice box, and that is what saved his life. So again, that is one of the most laughed at scenes in the history of cinema. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Indiana Jones jumps inside a
lead-lined refrigerator.
A lead-lined refrigerator, and like the refrigerator is like tossed 50 miles away by the nuclear explosion, and he's fine. I don't know that that is exactly accurate, but the idea that you could jump inside an icebox and survive a nuclear explosion, again, a nuclear explosion of the size that happened back in the 40s, but still, it is, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, even if they are bigger, and I think most nuclear bombs are calculated and like, so this would be like 10 Hiroshimas or Hiroshimas. Right. Is it pronounced Hiroshima?
Well, if you're Japanese, it's Hiroshima.
Hiroshima.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. That was good.
There we go.
Well, the one thing that kind of makes it very bizarrely personal to me is, so during the World War, because my mom's from Japan, and she was born in 1947, but prior to that, her parents, they lived in Tokyo, but because of all the fire, like all the bombings and firebombings in Tokyo, they had to flee to Niigata, where my grandfather had some family that would take them in. And Niigata was actually supposed to be one of the original targets of the A-bomb. But because of weather, the target switched. And like the day before, the like mayor had like told them, like, look, it's very possible that like we're going to be hit with a bomb. So they had an evacuation order. And my grandparents, they played their last hand going to Niigata. So they're like, we don't even know where we're going to go. So they're just like, look, if we're going to go, like, we'll, like, this is it. And just due to weather and, you know, in a very bittersweet turn of events, it ended up being Nagasaki that was actually bombed.
Yeah.
So it's wild to think that, just the history, it can affect people in so many ways. And just even something like visibility that day can just completely alter the course.
Literally the cloud cover, which is, you know, weather is the most random thing in the universe.
Yeah.
Based on my favorite scientific documentary, The Butterfly Effect,
featuring
Ashton Kutcher.
Yes. Wow, that's two Ashton Kutcher mentions.
Two Ashton
We're not being paid by Ashton Kutcher, by the way.
Speak for yourself.
Okay.
But Yeah, they made like three passes over the city that was their primary target, and because it was like more military and less residential before they eventually moved on to Nagasaki. Yeah.
Well, Niigata they used as like a port city to get people from Japan to the mainland of Asia, so that was sort of like the reason they targeted that town. But it's also interesting to think like the influence that the bomb has even had on like anime and manga too. There's I was just reading this IO9 article about it. And it's very true. Like you talk about the sort of the kinds of things we see, like from Astro Boy, who's like a misuse of technology, or like orphaned kids from like or mutants, like from Grave of the Fireflies. It affects the zeitgeist in many ways.
Godzilla, Akira, it's all kind of about those, the effects of World War II. It's really interesting how that is such a seminal moment in Japanese culture and something that in America we almost never think about anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it was interesting. We were early watching a video of like how people go out to the desert. Was it like White Sands or whatever, where one of the first atomic bomb tests going, and like people go there to be like, "Wow, this is when we the world changed." And that's the view from the American side is, you know, this ended the war, and like this is a crazy thing. Whereas like in Japan, I mean, like, you know, August 6th and the 9th, it's still, you have moments of silence, and it's, again, everyone's relationship to this is very, very different, and runs the entire gamut.
Yeah. The way it affected American culture that has sort of been erased from history is that America was like crazy about nuclear explosions. You could, in the 50s and 60s, go out to Las Vegas and there would be like nuclear explosions on the horizon. They had a beauty pageant that was like Miss A-Bomb, and like they basically threw parties watching these nuclear tests happen from a distance.
Like you bought tickets just to go see a mushroom cloud off in the distance?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But yeah, they were testing nuclear bombs like crazy, and it was terrible for the environment. One sort of thing that's not as bad as it is in the popular imagination is that the radiation tends to go down after a couple days. It's not like permanently, you know, uninhabitable, which tends to be how people think of it. So hopefully that was informative.
That'll help you sleep easier.
Yeah. I'm really glad I had a kid 5 days ago. Maybe I should have thought about that before
Hey, just double up on that onesie.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, two onesies.
Bleak.
All right. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back after this. And we're back. So we're just going to run through a handful of things that are happening right now. Start off with Papa John. Fuck Papa John.
Well, I mean, yeah.
My take on things.
Not because their pizza's shitty, but because...
Well, that too.
Their pizza also sucks.
Yeah, it's trash. Yeah.
Their pizza tastes like you have sprinkled like a bunch of sugar over it.
It tastes
terrible.
Like, tastes like diabetic shock.
It's like cardboard dildos in pizza form.
Yeah.
They're in the news because basically after Papa John's tried to blame his like huge stock price tumble on the NFL protests because, that's what's making your pizza taste like shit. The alt-right was like embracing Papa John's. We're like, well, we're like, this is our new pizza. And they had to come out and be like, whoa. We are not the official pizza of the alt-right, and we reject racism and discrimination in all forms. It's just funny that you have to say shit like companies have to say shit like that.
Right. And also,
I feel really bad for Celeste's Pizza because they've lost the alt-right to Papa John's now because they love frozen pizzas.
And that's a new, they can throw them on the pile of other white nationalist brands like New Balance and Fred Perry polo shirts and what else? Wendy's, because someone tweeted a Pepe the Frog meme. So, yeah.
Yeah, but those brands did nothing other than happen to get worn or used by the white nationalists, whereas
exactly.
Papa John... is a shitty dude who did blame his loss in stock value on activism. So fuck Papa John. Gun control, just real quick, Trump has come out with a couple arguments in the aftermath of the Texas church shooting. He said it's a mental health issue. He said that gun control would have caused hundreds of more deaths. So just real quick, taking those in order, the idea that it's a mental health issue, why is America the place with the vast majority of the mass shootings? Does America have worse mental health than other countries? No, you know, there are crazy people everywhere, but they do have, you know, when you look at the ratio of mass shootings to other countries and then amount of guns to other countries, they basically line up. So that is just how logic would dictate the sort of correlation going there.
Although not to say that we could be spending a little bit more on mental health in this country.
Yeah,
not that it's connected, but I would.
We could point out that Republican President Ronald Reagan cut quite a bit of funding to public mental institutions during his presidency, which has contributed greatly to our homelessness problem, especially in this city.
I remember as a kid when I was 7 years old, I asked my dad, like, I'd had that existential question as a kid. I was like, why is there homeless people? And he literally said, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it till like I got to college.
There you go.
So that way to explain that to me, Dad.
And then his argument that gun control would have caused hundreds of deaths assumes that gun control only prevents bad people from getting guns and not good.
Yeah, because his argument was like, if there's extreme vetting, then your good guy with a gun wouldn't have been able to get his gun to fight the bad guy.
But there's no gun control argument that says keep guns out of the hands of good guys.
Or responsible gun owners.
Like, people in England have, like, responsible hunters have guns, and that's okay. But England has tons of restrictions on gun ownership, and so...
Most of the cops don't even have guns.
Right,
right.
And it's not like the bad guys there are able to get guns on the black market and just shoot all the cops. Now, the argument from gun rights activists would be, well, America has just way more guns out there, right? There's just tons of guns. So if you create a law legislating, you know, the ability to purchase AR-15s, then you're essentially taking the AR-15 out of the hand of the good guy, and, you know, the bad guy's still going to try and buy an AR-15 on the black market. I think in this specific shooting, both the bad guy and the good guy with a gun had AR-15s. So that would be their argument there. I'm sure that would be Trump's argument there. You know, we've talked in the past about how Australia solved this. There was a mass shooting there. They not only created legislation, but they also had a huge gun buyback. And by incentivizing both good guys and bad guys to give back their guns, they took a bunch of guns out of circulation and haven't had a mass shooting since. We've tried gun buybacks in the United States, but it just doesn't work without pairing it with the legislation. I mean, that's what Australia had. They had the buyback plus stricter gun laws. And obviously we can't, get stricter legislation with the NRA being as powerful as they are currently, and, you know, we'll get into why the NRA is that powerful. But just in general, you know, when there's a advocacy group, you know, if the NRA was actually advocating for responsible gun ownership, they would not want to oppose this sort of thing. They would want to, you know, make laws that made it possible for responsible gun owners to be the only ones who had guns. But that doesn't seem to be how they respond to situations like this. And we're going to get into this a little later this week about how the NRA operates and how the NRA got to be this hugely influential thing. But
and if it is a mental health issue, I respectfully request an actual solution to that problem. Right. As opposed to, oh, it's a mental health problem, but we will not...
Moving on.
Yeah, we're not going to propose any legislation to fix it. It's just that it's not a gun issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of moving on, Carter Page, he recently testified and made the Steele dossier look pretty good.
Yeah, the transcript of his testimony came out, and it's a doozy. We'll probably get into that in more depth because it reads like a bizarro Coen Brothers script.
Yeah,
so
he is a Coen Brother character, like the way they get patheticness, like pitch perfect.
Yeah, I mean, look, this dude can't stop going on MSNBC and getting like gotcha'd. So I it's unbelievable. Like, yeah, again, Carter Page.
Gil, wow. You did it again.
Yeah.
Syria has signed the climate accord.
Hey.
So the last holdout besides the United States has signed the Paris Climate Accord. It now is just the United States and...
Versus the world.
Yep.
Syria be trolling, man. That's the only reason why they signed it. It's like, we're going to get the United States. We're going to sign this thing as a joke.
And by the way, the Republican tax plan removes the tax break for electric cars. Meanwhile, Shanghai and, you know, China has recently announced that they are going to phase out the internal combustion engine. So, power is going in opposite directions on that one. We'll see which one's better for the world.
I can't even believe that we used to just be in the company of Syria and that was bad enough. Like, you're the two countries that aren't like fucking with like recognizing climate change. And now it's just us.
We are a third world country, let's be honest.
Yeah, we're a third world country with really nice consumer goods.
Yeah.
And finally, Ric Flair has come out and revealed that he slept with 10,000 women.
What? That gets a woo!
I would like to see the reporting, the proof.
Yeah.
Does he have a book where he's got all the names? Does he have hash marks on his bedpost? What has he done to prove that he slept with 10,000 women? I know he's a 16-time world heavyweight champion because I can watch the matches.
Mm-hmm.
I can't watch that. Not that I would want to. But, I mean, how can you prove a statement like that? I could say that right now.
Yeah.
Right. I slept with 10,001 women.
Ooh.
Oh, newsflash. Shit, really? That's amazing.
I know.
But you've met him. Do you think, does he strike you as a man who, like, even maybe he slept with, like, 500 women?
He's definitely a player.
Okay.
He also is well-known within the professional wrestling community for having a very large penis.
Oh.
Cool.
Yeah. Wait, but how did Will Chamberlain ever have proof for his receipts? Did he ever have receipts?
Certainly not. No. How do you have 10,000 receipts? Yeah. I don't even keep the receipts to do my taxes.
If anything, this just makes Will Chamberlain's claim seem ridiculous because Chamberlain claimed 20,000. And like when you think like 10,000 seems like so crazy. And then he's like, yeah, I doubled that.
That would mean you'd have to have sex with like three women every day of the year for like 17 years straight or something like that.
Yeah. There's probably like days where it's a really heavy flow and some days where it's a light flow.
Right.
Like, oh, I got 20, I banged out 25, but yesterday was only 4.
Yeah.
Let me just do some math. 20,000 divided by 365. That would mean you would have to have sex with one person every day for 54.79 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know,
how long did he live?
To 50.
Yes.
Well, so, again, he probably had sex with two or three ladies at a time.
At a time. Every day? Like, even on Christmas? Even on New Year's? Even on Thanksgiving?
Definitely on Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah.
You gotta let that thing cool off for a while, you know? Yeah.
After a while, he'd be like, look, I'm so sorry about this. I just can't do it anymore.
Never mind this horrible crotch rash that I have.
Well, they call me the Nature Boy.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us. This was a blast. Congratulations on
your
newborn son. Where can people follow you on the internet?
I am at Dave_Schilling on Twitter. Not at Dave Schilling. There is an at Dave Schilling. That's not me. And you should watch CinemaCope, my web series on Super Deluxe. It comes out every week. I just reviewed Thor Ragnarok, which is an excellent movie.
Yeah.
And I'm actually, based off that evidence, I'm going to try and smoke green crack and watch Rosemary's Baby.
There you go. You've seen it.
I was like,
show.
Look at this guy pairing weed with a horror film.
What a clever guy.
Next level content, baby.
Thank you so much.
Miles, where can people follow you?
Oh, you can follow me at Miles of Gray on Twitter and Instagram.
You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien on Twitter. You can follow us at Daily Zeitgeist on Twitter. Our website is dailyzeitgeist.com, where you can find our episodes and also our footnotes, where we link to all the crazy shit that we've been saying. We show our sources. We show our work. You can find us at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram, and our Facebook fan page is The Daily Zeitgeist. And that's going to do it for today. We will be back tomorrow because it is a daily podcast. Talk to you then.